Thank you. I'm Patty, and I'm an alcoholic. And I'm grateful to be sober and be in a meeting of Alcoholics Anonymous. I would have been here sooner, but Roger forgot to save me a seat. So we were sitting out in the lobby having dinner. He's had a lot of things to worry about, though. I want to thank Bill for calling me and inviting me to participate in your convention. I love Florida. It's so flat here. I got in, and y'all have some bugs here that we don't have in California. I'm not sure what they are, but they attacked me. And let me put this down. I want to know why Lynn and John had little tables here with water on them. They're all set up nice. Anyway, these bugs attacked me, and I had big welts all over me, and I was swollen up, and we got into the hotel, and I ran into my friend Mert, who's at table 35, all dressed up. And I figured since she was from Florida, she'd know about these bugs. And so I told her that these bugs had attacked me, and I was itching, and I was swollen. And Mert says, "Well, do you have any alcohol?" And I knew I was in the right place. Alcohol always fixed it for me. Alcohol was always the thing that took care of it, whatever it was. And I knew I was home, and I knew I was going to be all right. My friend Cindy came with me from California, and I want to thank her for that. She got sober in Florida. If there's anyone here from Winter Haven or Lakeland, she's at table 33. She's particularly looking for her ex-boyfriend. She can't remember his name, though, so. Cindy got sober in Florida, and she tells me that real AA is in Florida. So I'm happy. So I'm happy to be here this evening to present a little bit of Let's Pretend Alcoholics Anonymous from California. Somebody mentioned earlier that we had like 18 million meetings a week in Orange County. It's because we're sicker there than anywhere else. We need more meetings. So I guess I should tell you the book. Whenever I have an opportunity to do this, I bring a note with me. And the note very simply says, "Tell them your name and tell them the truth." I've told you my name. I'm not so sure I'm going to tell you the truth. What I'm going to share with you is my perspective of what it used to be like. A lot of it was reported to me by other people. A lot of it's documented, so we can go back and look it up. But I don't know about anybody in this room, but when I was out there, when I was practicing, which I think is really a bizarre word, I didn't need a lot of practice. I was really good at drinking. When I was out there, I had no idea I was going to end up here. I had no idea the day would come that I would be in a meeting of Alcoholics Anonymous sharing with you what it used to be like. If I had known I was going to end up here, I would have taken notes while I was out there. I would have certainly done some things differently. There's a lot of things I just simply would not have done if I would have known the day was going to come that I would end up in Alcoholics Anonymous. So what I'm going to share with you was reported to me, and I pretty much have to believe that what they told me it was like was true. The story that I'd like to tell you is I'd like to tell you that I was a Kansas City housewife, sat on the sofa and I drank a little white wine. One day I burnt the toast and I realized my life was unmanageable. So I rushed to Alcoholics Anonymous. I looked at the 12 steps of recovery. I knew they were the solution to the problems in my life. I worked them all in the first week and skyrocketed to recovery. That's a story I would like to tell you. Unfortunately, that's not my story. I was responsible one time for a fire that gutted the entire inside of a house. And I imagine somewhere in that house was a loaf of bread. Consequently, I did burn the toast, but it wasn't enough to get me to Alcoholics Anonymous. I had my first drink when I was 13 years old. I'm really sorry I waited that long. I grew up in an alcoholic home, and I didn't know it was alcoholism. I didn't know that my home was any different than anybody else's home. I didn't make any vows not to ever drink, and at the same time, I never planned to drink. I never had any illusions about alcohol. I never thought about it one way or the other. And yet at 13 years old, I was on a camping trip one weekend with a group of girls on the beach in Southern California. And we got into the tent that night. I had a bottle of vodka in my pillowcase. And to this day, I don't know where that bottle came from. But I pulled it out, and I remember being excited about having it. I had no idea what alcohol would do to me or for me, but I was excited about having that bottle. And I asked if anybody wanted any of it, and they didn't. And the reason they gave me for not wanting it was all we had to mix with it was grape soda and root beer. And I said, so what? And I took the top off, and I drank half the bottle, and I looked around, and nothing had gotten different, and nothing had changed, so I drank the second half of the bottle.
And that was to be the
end of my social drinking. Never again after that day did I ever offer anybody a drink out of my bottle. And I don't know about anybody in this room, but I never had a resentment until I came to Alcoholics Anonymous. One of my earliest resentments here was I would hear you talk about your first drink. And you would talk about your first drink, and you talk about taking the drink and feeling the warmth in your throat, and somehow you would feel that warmth magically go down to your stomach, and it would hit your stomach, and it would explode, and it would go to your fingernails and your toenails, and your pimples would fall off, and you'd grow 4 inches taller, you'd lose 20 pounds, and you became Prince Charles and Lady Di, and wonderful things happened to you. I had my first drink of alcohol, and absolutely nothing happened to me for about 15 minutes. And at the end of the 15 minutes, the only thing that happened to me was that I had to go to the bathroom. And it's my belief today that if you drank a quart of anything, you would have to go to the bathroom in about 15 minutes. And I got out of the tent. We were at the beach. I shuffled through the sand to the outhouse. I went in and went to the bathroom. And when I got done and went to get up, I realized I was absolutely, totally, 100% paralyzed to the toilet seat. I couldn't blink my eyelids. I didn't feel my heart breathing and beating, and I was overcome with a sense of doom. And the fear was that somebody else was going to have to come use that outhouse, and there I was, paralyzed to the toilet seat. Now, I don't know how I knew it, but intuitively I knew that the body was made up of energy. And I knew that if I could gather that energy, if I could get it till it all seemed to be in one central location, I would be all right. And I guess it was my first experience with meditation, because I gathered my energy. I just gathered it from any place it might have been in my body, and when it seemed to be all in one central location, I fell out the door into the sand and started crawling back to the tent. Now, since coming to Alcoholics Anonymous, I've discovered that my entire problem that night was my attitude. If my attitude would have been right, I could have had this fantasy that I was in the Marines and I was being dive-bombed as I was trying to get back to safety. And if my attitude would have been right, it could have been a wonderful experience. In my own defense, I need to tell you, my pants were still down at my ankles. I had started to get sick. I couldn't quite get through it. I couldn't get around it. And under those circumstances, it's a little difficult to have a good attitude. I did somehow manage to get back to the tent. I fell in and I passed out. When I came to in the morning, I realized nobody was in the tent with me. And I couldn't figure out where they went until my eyes cleared enough. I discovered I'd been sick all night long. I'd hit the top of the tent, the side of the tent, the floor. I had not missed a square inch, and I didn't want to be in the tent either. So I got out of there, and that was my first drink of alcohol, and it was the most wonderful, incredible, marvelous fabulous, spiritual, magnificent experience I'd ever had. And it must have been because I put some amount of alcohol into my body on a daily basis from that day until the day I walked through the doors of Alcoholics Anonymous. And I didn't always get drunk, and I didn't always drink the kinds of things that you would classify as a beverage. I drank a lot of vanilla extract. I used to buy it by the six-pack. I remember the day the manager of the market called me over, and he said, "Patty, I can't let you buy vanilla extract anymore." He said, "I can't believe anybody bakes as much as you do." I drank a lot of mouthwash. I drank a lot of perfume. Taboo became my after-dinner drink of choice. I'm often tempted when I share at a meeting of Alcoholics Anonymous, I'm often tempted to introduce myself and say, "I'm Patty and I'm a pig." Because I ate, drank, shot, snorted, shoved, crammed, rammed anything into me that made me feel different than how I felt. But I love alcohol. Alcohol is my drug of choice. I love the way it looks. I love the way it sounds. I love the way it smells. I love alcohol. And what drug of choice means for me is that if there's a bottle of Jack Daniels here, some marijuana, some cocaine, some Valium, some stuff, drug of choice means I drink the Jack Daniels first, and then I do everything else. I graduated from high school. I went to college. I went to San Diego State College. I graduated from there with a 3.8 grade point average. It almost killed me when I got to Alcoholics Anonymous because I believed I was too smart to be an alcoholic. I stayed at San Diego and took classes for a master's degree. I was a chronic, hopeless, helpless alcoholic, and I didn't have a clue. I thought I drank because I wanted to drink. I left San Diego. I believed I was leaving San Diego because I had taken all the classes San Diego State had to offer. That's why I thought I was leaving. I did not think I was leaving because I had one more drunk driving assault charge pending. Another resentment I got in Alcoholics Anonymous, I came here and found out you can get arrested for a single charge of drunk driving. I always got arrested for drunk driving assault. And it had something to do with how I got out of the car. I didn't think I was leaving San Diego because I had a roommate who was a little annoyed with me. Now, I know we're not supposed to talk about them, but I have to tell you about my roommate. I was a bar drinker. I was a living room drinker, a bathroom drinker, a kitchen drinker, an alley drinker, a gutter drinker, a dumpster drinker, a library drinker. I mean, I didn't really specialize, but I love bars. I love sleazy bars. I love 6 a.m. sleazy bars. I love those places where you walk in and it's full of smoke and there's that kind of used booze urine smell. I salivate yet when I think about it. It's like, but I was a bar drinker. I did all the things women bar drinkers do. I did a lot of things men bar drinkers do. I was never real particular about my behavior, but I'm a chronic, hopeless, helpless alcoholic, but even in the worst of my disease, I had a tremendous amount of compassion. And I would be in one of those bars and, some guy would, if you guys get offended by this, you probably deserve it, but the men who drank in the kinds of bars I drank in had two basic lines. "My wife doesn't understand, and I have no place to stay tonight." That was generally the end of their dialogue. And I have a tremendous amount of compassion. So I would, some guy would come on to me with one of those lines, and I'd look at him and say, "Listen, I'll take you home with me tonight, but I don't want to talk to you again until the bar closes." So the bar would close, being a lady of my word, I would take this guy home with me. And we'd get to my house, and I would send him into the bedroom telling him I had to go to the bathroom, which, weak kidneys, I thought was my only character defect when I got to Alcoholics Anonymous. I sent him into the bedroom on the right, and I went into my bedroom on the left, and I had just sent him in with my roommate. Now, some nights that was okay with her. Some nights she didn't mind at all. Other nights it would really irritate her, and within a matter of minutes they'd be banging and screaming at my bedroom door, which I had, of course, locked. I had 7 o'clock classes. I had to get some rest here. And she was so inconsistent. If it would have always been all right or never been all right, I'd have been okay. But she was so inconsistent. You'd have drank if you lived with her. I mean, it was... And I didn't think I was leaving because she was a little annoyed with me. I truly believed I was leaving because I had taken all the classes San Diego State had to offer. And I left San Diego. I was going to Chico, California, which is in Northern California, to start my career. I loaded up my car with everything I owned. I had 2 cases of beer, 2 bottles of booze, and I headed north. I got 66 miles north of San Diego to Santa Ana. I was out of booze, and I was thirsty. I pulled off the first street off-ramp. I have a sense I can find the sleaziest bar in town without even looking for it. I pulled into the parking lot of this place. I walked in. There was sawdust on the floor. Somebody had thrown up several days before that. They hadn't cleaned it up. It was full of smoke. Willie Nelson was singing on the jukebox, and I knew I was home. That's as far north as I ever got, 66 miles from where I started from. Alcohol had become my mother, my father, my lover, my friend, my God, my companion, my support, and at some point it had turned, and it controlled every area of my life. It controlled where I would live, where I would work, the people I would run with, and eventually the people I would run from, and I didn't have a clue. I thought I drank because I wanted to drink. I didn't know that I didn't have a choice. I stayed there in that bar, and I was offered a job. I took it. I lived for 2 weeks in my car. And I went to work in my chosen field, and I rose very quickly to the top. That almost killed me in Alcoholics Anonymous, too, because when I got here, I told you how successful I had been. I told you about the big oak desk I sat behind. I told you about the trophies on the wall, the plaques in the case, and I told you about how successful I was. What I didn't tell you about was I was in the newspaper business, and we were a community paper, and that wasn't unusual because we were a community paper. We often gave awards, and because God had given me a gift, we often received awards. And so it was not unusual for me to come to behind a podium much like this in a room full of people holding an award, not knowing if I was giving it or receiving it. And I would say thank you, and I would go sit down, and somebody would elbow me and tell me I was presenting it to the Junior Women's League, and I'd have to get up and start over again. I didn't tell you about that. I didn't tell you about the mornings at 5 a.m. that I came to wrapped around the leg of that big oak desk, and the cleaning ladies coming in. I don't know anybody but an Al-Anon who enjoys the sound of a vacuum cleaner. And she's... I'm sorry, Lynn. Lynn's my Al-Anon sponsor. He goes to the meetings, I get well. I don't know how that happens. Well, it hasn't helped him at all, I'll tell you that. And I'm laying around that, and she's coming in with the vacuum cleaner, and I'm trying to tell her I don't need my office cleaned today. I like it this way. And I know there's a bottle in that bottom desk drawer, and if I can just get a hit off of that bottle, I'm going to be okay. And I didn't tell you about that stuff. I just told you about how successful I was, and I told you about the awards that I won. And it almost killed me in Alcoholics Anonymous. I got here as a direct result of one more drunk driving assault charge. The sheriff in Orange County, California, has absolutely no sense of humor. I'm the kind of person, I get arrested, I get released from jail, I get the arrest report, and I read it, and I find out where I made my mistake so I can practice that part so that next time I'll get that part right. And I had practiced field sobriety tests a lot. I was really, really good at field sobriety tests. And on this last arrest, I was doing a fine job. I'd have given myself an A+. I was doing an excellent job. And at the end of the test, the officer asked me to say the ABCs backwards. Well, the time before I had responded with, well, I can't even do that sober. Well, then I had just confessed, and he cuffed me, and he took me off to jail. So on this last time when he asked me to say the ABCs backwards, I said, okay, and I turned around. See, y'all think it was funny. He didn't think it was funny at all. I just turned around, he cuffed me, and he took me to Orange County Jail, and he put me in a cell with criminals. And I knew I didn't belong there. I mean, there were real criminals in there. There were burglars, there were thieves, there were prostitutes, there were women who'd been arrested for beating their husband, which I don't think should be a crime, but in California they lock you up for it. And I knew I didn't belong there, so I tried to organize a prison break. And I explained this plan very carefully to the criminals. It was a simple plan. We're going to get our coffee cups, we're going to bang them on the door, on the bars. When the marshal comes to see what's going on, I'm throwing my arm out around the bars, get her around the neck, get her keys, and we're getting out of here. And I heard something I was to hear in Alcoholics Anonymous. One of those criminals looked at me and she said, "Why don't you sit down and shut up?" And I said, "Fine, then y'all stay, but I'm getting out." Now I was going like a mad woman on those bars. There's a couple problems with styrofoam cups. The first one is they don't make a lot of noise. The second one is the bars have a tendency to eat them up. And when the bars ate it up and it got to my knuckles and it got painful, I sat down and I shut up. And several hours later, they came to the cell and they called my name and I was being released on an OR. And I hadn't been released on an OR in a very long time. And I knew they were making a mistake. But I didn't think I should be the one to tell them about it. They took me to a telephone. They told me I could make one phone call. I stood there for 5 minutes. I could not think of one person who I could call to come pick me up from Orange County Jail. I certainly couldn't call anybody in my family. And there was nobody who I considered a friend that I could call to come pick me up. And I knew isolation and loneliness, and I didn't know that's what I knew. And after about 5 minutes, the name of a woman who had worked for me at one time went through my head, and with that alcoholic arrogance, I called her, and I didn't ask her. I told her to come pick me up at Orange County Jail, and she did, and she took me back to where my car was, and I was getting out of her car. She looked at me, and she said, "Patty, I don't ever want to see you again. I don't want to hear from you, and I don't want to hear about you, and as far as I'm concerned, you no longer exist." And then she drove off. I gave her one of these, and I thought, then fine, I'll do it myself. You see, I've been raised all my life to know that I needed to do it myself. I didn't need you or they or them. I couldn't depend on you. I didn't need her. If I couldn't do it, it didn't need to get done. And I reconfirmed that commitment that morning, and I did the only thing I knew how to do. I went to the bar, and I told the guys how they had done it to me one more time. One more time, it was you and they and them. One more time, it was circumstances and conditions. One more time, it was the cops. One more time, it was a lot of things. It never occurred to me it had anything to do with alcohol. I went to court on that charge. I was 26 years old. I stood in that courtroom drunk. It's the only way I went to court. It's the only way I went to the grocery store. It's the only way I went to work. It's the only way I went to the laundromat. It's the only way I did anything. And I stood there drunk at 26 years old, being sentenced to 10 years in prison. And in the middle of sentencing me, the expression on the judge's face changed. The tone of his voice got different. And I knew he was as surprised at what he was saying as I was at what I was hearing. Because he looked at me and he said, "I know this won't work for you, but I'm going to offer you one more chance." And he offered me an alternative. And part of that alternative was meetings of Alcoholics Anonymous. I wish I could tell you that I left that courtroom, I came here, I looked at the 12 steps of recovery, I knew they were the solution to the problems in my life. I worked them all in the first week and skyrocketed to recovery. But it's not my story. I drank for 3 more months. In retrospect, I can tell you that I drank with a sense of urgency and a desperation that I had never known. I didn't drink a greater quantity. Physically, it would have been impossible to drink a greater quantity of alcohol. But I drank with a sense of urgency and a desperation that I had never known. And on October 4th, 1975, the day before I was to go back to court to tell the judge what it was I was doing with the alternative he gave me, on that day, I went to my first meeting of Alcoholics Anonymous, and it was a Sunday night. Lynn Wilder was there and his wife. I thought Lynn was the president of AA when I went to that meeting. Found out later he thought he was, too. And it was a speaker meeting. It was a Sunday night. I heard 2 things in that meeting. I heard the answers were in the book, Alcoholics Anonymous, so after the meeting, I stole the book. I mean, God knows I need to have the answers. And the other thing I heard was that we don't drink between meetings. So I quickly looked around. Nobody was drinking during the meeting. And I thought, if you don't drink between meetings and you're not drinking during the meeting, when do you drink? that made me a little nervous. I got home from that first meeting. I can't tell you how upset I was. Not only could I not find the answers in that book, I couldn't even find the questions. And I thought, oh, dear God, I've stolen the wrong book, and I'm going to have to go back. I'm going to have to go back and get the right one. And that's what brought me to my second meeting of Alcoholics Anonymous. I came back to Alcoholics Anonymous to get the answer book. I don't think it matters what brings us back, as long as we come back. My second meeting was Wednesday. I had 4 days of sobriety. I didn't shake. I leapt. I would be on my couch, and I would be at my kitchen table. Then I would be on my bed, which was upstairs. I didn't know how I was getting to all these places. And I had no idea it had to do with alcohol. I thought I was nervous. People made me nervous. I didn't like people. I hear women say, you know, when I got to Alcoholics Anonymous, I didn't like women. I didn't like women. I didn't like men. I didn't like children. I hated animals. And there were a lot of people at that first meeting. I thought it was just I was nervous from all those people that were at that A&A meeting. And so Wednesday, with 4 days of sobriety, I went to my second meeting. It was a small discussion meeting. And in that meeting, I heard, if you want what we have and are willing to go to any length to get it. And I looked around the room, and I looked around the room, and I looked around the room, and I could not figure out what it was that you had that I should be willing to go to any length to get it. Some of you had nice jewelry. If you stood next to me during the Lord's Prayer, if your rings were loose, they were mine. Some of you have nice cars. I have a record for Grand Theft Auto. I knew how to get those. I could not figure out what it was you had, and then I saw him. And I truly believe there's a him for each of us. Shame on you. This man was a skinny little fellow. He was bald-headed. He wore baggy pants and a thin belt. He had tennis shoes on with no shoelaces, but the holes were there where they should have been. And he nodded out during the meeting. And I thought, if I have to do this thing and not drink, I want to do it his way. So I found out where he worked, and the next day I snuck down to his office. And I went in and I said, Dick, I have to do this thing called Alcoholics Anonymous to stay out of jail, and I don't know how to do it. And he told me if I would go to meetings and read the book, talk to other alcoholics and not drink, so I guarantee you, you won't get drunk. And if you don't get drunk, your life will get different. And I'm grateful he told it to me that way. He didn't tell me my life would get better. He didn't tell me my finances would get better, my relationships would get better, my family life would get better, my sex life would get better. He didn't tell me any of it would get better, and I'm grateful, because none of it has. I always like to offer a little hope to the newcomer. But it's all gotten different. And as I stand here tonight, I can tell you from the top of my head to the tip of my toes, I have never had it so good. You see, I don't know good from bad for me. If I'm going through something I think is good for me, it generally turns out to be bad for me. And if I'm going through something I think is bad for me, it generally turns out to be good for me. I don't know good from bad for me, but I know what different is. I've gone through times in my sobriety where it just seemed like my entire life was falling apart. It looked like everything that I had gained was being taken away from me. I truly believe that God had indeed brought me this far and dropped me on my ass, and it looked like my whole life was falling apart more times than one in Alcoholics Anonymous. But I didn't drink, and I didn't die, and I got to the other side, and in retrospect, I saw that it hadn't been falling apart. That was what was happening is that it was falling together. And I don't know good from bad for me, but I know what different is. And I've learned in Alcoholics Anonymous, it's been my experience, that you don't drink. And in retrospect, I can tell you that I have never had it so good. Every area of my life is different than when I walked through the doors of Alcoholics Anonymous. And all I came here for was to stay out of jail. That's all I wanted out of this deal. And I have gotten so much more. And I believed that old man that day, and I don't know why. I hadn't believed another human being in a very long time, but I believed him. And I left his office, and I had the book, so I'd open it to chapter 3, and I'd read the line that says, most of us are unwilling to admit we are real alcoholics. And I'd say, amen, and close the book. And that was reading the book. I'd go down to the Canyon Club in Laguna Beach where we have AA meetings. I'd have a cup of coffee on the way out. I'd say hi, Jim, to the manager, and he'd say hi, Patty, and that was talking to another alcoholic. My court card said I had to go to two meetings a week. I thought that was a little obsessive, but I was willing to go any lengths to stay out of jail. So I went to the two meetings a week that my court program said I had to go to, and the only thing I did right was I didn't drink. And for me, it took 8.5 months of not drinking to get far enough away from my last drink to see the evidence of my alcoholism. For 8.5 months, I came here twice a week. I was not an alcoholic. I would not be an alcoholic. I had absolutely no social skills. I thought going out to dinner was when the guy next to you at the bar bought you a slab of beef jerky. If he bought you a pickled egg, you had to go to bed with him. I mean, that's... I used to say I talk like a sailor, and then I went to some meetings in San Diego, and they don't talk like I talk. I had the ability to string four-letter profanities together in such a way that you thought it made sense. I talked at every meeting I went to. I didn't care if it was a speaker meeting or a discussion meeting. I had something to say. I like going to meetings at the Canyon Club because they had these little pots of coffee on the table, and I could hurl one of those suckers all the way across the room. I threw a chair at a fellow one night, missed him, and broke a plate glass window. I was 6 months sober, and a guy said something I didn't like. I jumped him, beating his head into the concrete floor. He didn't say it to me, just shared it. I took it personally. Took six guys to get me off of him, and when they did, I knew they were going to tell me I had to leave Alcoholics Anonymous. They got me off of him, and one of those men looked at me, and he said, Patty, he said, next time you feel that volcano about to explode, he said, just put your hands in your pockets and don't touch another human being. And I wondered how he knew about the volcano. I had a volcano inside of me, and it would erupt, and when it erupted, I had to do something. When it erupted, I wanted to see blood, preferably yours. And when it erupted, I just didn't seem to have any control. And Alex told me to put my hands in my pockets and not to touch another human being. And I had to do that for a long time before I discovered that that anger was a cover for a tremendous amount of fear. I was absolutely scared to death. I was afraid of you. I was afraid of life. I was afraid of me. And I couldn't survive in the places I'd survived in with that kind of fear. So I'd begun to cover that fear with anger. And I acted it out in violence. And I did that in Alcoholics Anonymous. And you never threw me away. I would stand up and shout profanities, and usually some little blue-haired lady would turn around and say, keep coming back. And then I'd flip her off and wave my court card in her nose and tell her I didn't have a choice. And you gave me the dignity to do what I had to do for as long as I had to do it, until I got far enough away from my last drink to see the evidence of my alcoholism. It was piled this high. You all saw it when I came in. But you gave me the dignity to do what I had to do for as long as I had to do it, and I will be eternally grateful to the people that were in Alcoholics Anonymous when I walked through the doors, because they didn't tell me I had to leave. You never told me I had to be an alcoholic. You never told me I couldn't stay. All you ever said to me was keep coming back, and I abused you badly. I will never be able to repay that debt to Alcoholics Anonymous. And it took 8.5 months. 8.5 months of not drinking to get far enough away from my last drink to see the evidence of my alcoholism. And at 8.5 months sober, I took the first step of recovery in Alcoholics Anonymous. I admitted that I was powerless over alcohol. Whenever I do battle with alcohol, I lose. Whenever I get into the ring with alcohol, I lose. Whether I'm fighting it because I'm drinking it or I'm fighting it because you're drinking it. Whenever I do battle with alcohol, I lose, and I'm powerless. And my life had become unmanageable. Everything that happened in my life was a direct result of ingesting alcohol, the good things and the bad things, the successes and the failures, everything in my life. Alcohol controlled every area of my life. And it began to strip me of self-esteem, dignity, integrity, pride, decency, all the things that we have going for us as human beings. And when I came here, it had taken it all. By the time I came here, it had stripped me naked and it had taken it all. And my life had become unmanageable. I wish I could tell you after that that I looked at the next 11 steps, worked them all, and skyrocketed to recovery. But I need to tell you I have never worked one of the 12 steps until my back was against the wall. The pain was so great, it was do it or die, and I had no other choice. under those circumstances, I become very willing to work the next one of the 12 steps of Recovering Alcoholics Anonymous. And I want to talk about the steps tonight because that's what happened for me. What it was like, what happened, and what it's like now. The what happened for me are the 12 steps of Recovering Alcoholics Anonymous. There is no way to get from where I was to where I am tonight with you except for the power and the magic of the 12 steps of recovery. And I'm going to share my experience. If you disagree with anything I say, call your sponsor tonight. Step two for me, I came to believe that a power greater than myself would restore me to sanity. For me, sanity was how I thought. I'm an alcoholic, I'll always be an alcoholic. Every once in a while I have a thought that a drink would be nice. When I have that thought, I clap, I say thank you for your participation, I just go about whatever it is that I'm doing. But before, whenever I had a thought, I had to do it. Whenever I had a thought, I was raised Catholic. Now, I've stayed sober long enough that I don't blame the Catholic Church. I know today that I have a hearing problem. I've always had a hearing problem. It's not always what you say, it's how I hear it. But what I heard the nun say was I heard him say I was going to burn for just as long for thinking it as I was for doing it. Now, I've always been a kind of into action person. So if I had a thought, I took an action. Everything I thought, I did. What I came to believe in step two was that the day would come that I could have a thought and not take an action on it. I'm happy to tell you that's happened. I've got 2 lust attacks since I've been standing up here tonight. So far, I haven't taken an action on either one of them. I've done some things that I didn't even want to do. I've done some things that were disgusting. I even knew ahead of time were disgusting. But I had the thought, so I took the action. I think all the time. In California, we often tell new people not to think. I don't know how you do that. I think all the time. I'm talking to you. I'm thinking about something else. Then I start thinking about the fact that I'm thinking, and then I start thinking that I shouldn't be thinking what I'm thinking while I'm thinking. And then I try to think how not to think what I'm thinking while I'm thinking what I'm thinking that I shouldn't be thinking. I mean, I'm grateful I don't have a loudspeaker on my head so that everything I thought came barreling out. I mean, that would be truly humiliating, but I think all the time, and what I came to believe is that my thinking would somehow be in line with the rest of the world. And for me, the power greater than myself was not God. For me, the power greater than myself was not God, because I'm a loner by nature. I'm an isolator by nature. Alcoholics Anonymous doesn't change my nature. What it does is it gives me the courage and the strength to go against my nature. Left to my own devices, I will sit on my couch. That's where I prefer to be. The hardest thing for me to do is to come here and be with you. And what Alcoholics Anonymous gives me is the courage and the strength to get off of my couch and to live life. But I'm a loner by nature. If I had believed that God was going to restore me to sanity, and I've never had, well, I do have one, I've always had one problem with God. I've always believed in God. I knew we were all God's children. That was my problem because I wanted to be God's only child. That's the only problem I've had with God. I've always known there was a God. And if I had believed that God was going to do this, God would have flown into my house, sprinkled me with sanity while I sat on my couch, shot off to wherever God hangs out, and that would have been the end of it. So for me, for a loner, for an isolator, I had to come to believe that the power greater than myself was the action, the steps 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, 8, 9. That somehow through taking the action and the steps, that I would be restored to right thinking, and my thinking would be in line with the rest of the world, and I'm happy to tell you that's happened for me. Step three for me, I hear people talk about having difficulty with step three. I had no trouble with step three. When my back was against the wall, the pain was so great, it was do it or die, and I had no other choice. I looked at step three and saw that it said made a decision. I make 1,000 decisions a day. I'm really, really good at making decisions. Taking an action to implement the decision will give me some grief sometimes, but I have no problem making a decision. Then it occurred to me that I turned my will and my life over to the care of alcohol on a daily basis for 13 years. I've turned my will and my life over to the care of people even less qualified than myself a number of times. I've turned my will and my life over to the care of jobs. I've turned my will and my life over to the care of a lot of stuff. When the pain was so great it was do it or die and I had no other choice, it seemed a simple matter to make a decision to turn my will and my life over to the care of God as I understood Him. I'm happy to tell you that the decision I made did not become a reality until I took the action of steps 4, 5, 6, 7, 8, 9, and 10. And I'm happy to tell you that because through the process of taking the steps, my understanding of God changed over and over and over and over. Until the time that I took the action of those steps and got to step 11, I had an understanding of a God that was very gentle and very loving and very nurturing and very caring and wanted me to have it all. Step 4, I'm a writer by training. I, honest to God, I thought writing an inventory was for those of you who weren't writers. Those of you who weren't writers probably needed to write this inventory just to brush up on your creative writing skills. I didn't need to do it, though. I mean, I didn't need to do it, and I didn't 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 do it. And when I was a little over a year sober, I was at the Canyon Club, and a fellow who'd been around for about 20 days came into the club, and he had drank that day. And I sat and talked to him for about 45 minutes, and then I had to go to the bathroom, and I got up to go to the bathroom. When I came back, he was gone, and I asked somebody where he went, and they said he left. And I went out into the parking lot, and he was in his car, and I asked him where he was going, and he told me,
he said, I'm going to go home and sleep it off.
He said, but I'll be back tomorrow. And I looked at him, and I said, well, I hope so, because I love you. I was 27 years old. I was a little over a year sober. I had never said the words, I love you, in my entire life. You see, I was raised with love. My parents told me they loved me. Any more of their love, and I'd have died. Their love was physically, mentally, and emotionally abusive. And I, as a very small child, came to know that love was something very painful. If I loved you, I was going to have to hurt you. And if you loved me, you would hurt me. And I made a commitment as a small child to never love another human being. And I had never said the words, I love you, in my entire life. And when I said them to that man that night, I didn't know what they meant, but I knew what it felt like. And it wasn't that horrible, painful thing I thought love was. And as he drove out of the parking lot, I started to cry, and I hadn't cried since I was 8 years old. And the line in the book that says, those who do not recover are people who cannot or will not completely give themselves this simple program, that line went through my head. And I knew that if I was to recover in Alcoholics Anonymous, I'd have to give myself completely to this program. And that night, I chose to recover in Alcoholics Anonymous. My sobriety was a gift from a very gentle and a very loving God. There's a line in the book that talks about that we tried to control and enjoy our drinking. I think that's the funniest line ever written. It's absolutely impossible. You can either control or you can enjoy, but you can't do both. And I was always into enjoy. I never tried to control my drinking. It never occurred to me to cut down on my drinking. It never occurred to me to not drink. And yet on October 4th, 1975, for a reason I didn't understand for a very long time, on that day I didn't drink, and it wasn't my idea. And that night, a little over a year sober, when I chose to recover in Alcoholics Anonymous, I knew that my sobriety was a gift from a very gentle and a very loving God, because it would never have occurred to me. And when I chose to recover in Alcoholics Anonymous, I made a commitment, and I have continued to make that choice on a daily basis. And I began to go to meetings every night. And I would come into a meeting in pain, and I'd sit in the middle of you and feel isolated and alone. I felt different. I felt unique. I knew there was no sense sharing with you because you weren't going to understand anyway. And I left in more pain than I had come in with. And I came the next night in pain and sat in the middle of you and felt isolated and alone. I felt different. I felt unique. I knew there was no sense sharing with you because you weren't going to understand anyway. And I left in more pain than I'd come in with. And I did that night after night after night after night until the pain of being with you was so great that I knew I'd have to leave Alcoholics Anonymous. I knew I couldn't stay here in the kind of pain that I was in. And on my way out of the meeting that night, I had one of my thoughts. And the thought was, before you leave Alcoholics Anonymous, why don't you try writing this fourth step? So I went home and I did my fourth step exactly the way the book says to do it. I made the little columns. I wrote down everybody that I resented, which basically turned out to be everybody who breathed air that I thought should have been mine. And in the second column, I wrote what they did to me. Well, I wanted to tell you all my life what they did to me. I was having a great time doing this. I was really sorry I waited this long. And the third column, how it affected me. Well, it affected my security, my self-worth, my self-esteem. Well, no wonder I drank. If all these people did all these things to you that affected you this way, you'd have drank too. And I was really having fun. And then I accidentally turned the page. And two pages later, hidden in the body of the text, it says, referring to our list again, putting out of our minds the wrongs others had done, we looked at what our part was. Well, now it wasn't any fun anymore. Now I had to write down what my part was, and I did that with my resentments, my fears, and my relationships. And when I finished doing that, I knew that I belonged in Alcoholics Anonymous. I think we're all a little unique, but I truly believe that we all have exactly the same story. We just acted it out a little bit differently. And that's what I came to believe when I finished writing my fourth step. I knew that I could share with you and that you would understand. And I think Lynn said it the other night, if I hadn't done it, I'd thought about doing it. And I knew that if you hadn't done the things that I had done, you had at least thought about doing it. If you hadn't thought about it, you'd have been pretty irritated when I mentioned it to you that you hadn't thought of it. Then I looked at step five, and I, honest to God, I thought step five was for those of you who weren't raised Catholic. Those of us who are raised Catholic, we know about confession, and we know it doesn't work. And I thought sharing this would give the rest of you the same experience that we had. And so I didn't have to do it. I put my fourth step in the trunk of my car because I didn't want anybody to find it. And I drove around with a continual sense of impending doom. And the fear was that I was going to get rear-ended on the freeway, my trunk would fly open, my fourth step would be everywhere. Rather than do a fifth step, I chose to drive around that way for a very long time. And then one night I was in Los Angeles visiting a friend of mine, and we were talking, and as we were talking, I realized I was doing my fifth step. And I thought, well, if I'm going to do it, I'm going to do it right. And I went to the car, and I got my fourth step, and I went in, and I finished my fifth step with this woman. And when I got done, she looked at me, and she said, Patty, one day the things you have listed as your greatest assets will become your greatest liabilities. And the things you have listed as your greatest liabilities will become your greatest assets. And I thought, oh, wonderful, I've just done a fifth step with a woman who has lost her last marble. I need to tell you, as I stand here tonight, the things I have always thought were my greatest assets in Alcoholics Anonymous become my greatest liabilities. And the things I thought were my greatest liabilities here become my greatest assets. I don't know how that happened. An example, I'm a very strong woman. I've always been a very strong woman. If you're a strong woman, and I imagine this is true if you're a strong man, I've just never met one to confirm it with. You know, I'll tell you the truth. I pray. Whatever comes out comes from, you know, divine inspiration. Speaking of that, I want to thank the women who were in the ladies' room who offered to let me go up to the front of the line, and I want to thank the ones who were behind me because I was praying in there. That's what took me so long. Men have it easier. I mean, they just stand there and do it. Anyway, I think. I mean, that's what they tell me. If you're a strong person, it's very difficult to ask for help. If you're a strong person, it's very difficult. And whenever I try to do anything by myself, I shortchange myself. Whenever I try to do anything alone, I shortchange myself. Whenever I ask one of you to take my hand and walk with me, you open new doors and you add to my life. And that strength, which was always an asset, has become a liability because I will continue to shortchange myself over and over and over and over. In Alcoholics Anonymous, it becomes one of my greatest liabilities. I went home from doing my fifth step. I did step six and seven by mistake. I did not mean to recover this quickly. I took the book down, and by coincidence, it opened to that part about step six and seven. In the big book, it's really short, and the big book is not very well written. I mean, any newcomer will tell you that. But that part about step six and seven is kind of poetic, and I started reading it. I just kind of got lulled into it. And when I became aware of what I was reading, I was in the middle of the seven step prayer. And when I became aware of what I was reading, I knew that I believed it. And I finished reading the prayer, and the thing that it says in the book happened to me. I walked through the archway to freedom. I walked away from the person I had been all of my life to start to become the person God intended for me to be. The best I have ever described myself when I came here, I was an animal with latent human tendencies. That's what walked through the doors. That's what walked through the doors of Alcoholics Anonymous. As a result of you sharing with me your life, as a result of you sharing with me how to live life, as a result of the power and the magic of the 12 steps of recovery, that animal who walked through the doors, I've become a very kind, a very loving, a very gentle, a very nurturing person. Of course, now they're telling me it's codependency and I have to recover from it, but... I love the person who I am today. I love the person who I am. I'm tempted to write a book, Women Who Love Themselves Too Much. I was a little nervous. 6 and 7 make people a little nervous. They made me a little nervous. I thought, if God takes all the defects, what's going to be left? You notice I did not introduce myself as Saint Patio. There is no fear in that. What happened for me, I'm a visual person, and what happened with my character defects is God put them in this little wagon that I pull around with me all the time. I always have my little red wagon full of character defects, and when I think I need one, I pull it out of my wagon and I use it. When I don't like the way it feels, not when you don't like the way it looks, not when you don't like the way it feels, but when I don't like the way it feels, I ask God to take it, and he puts it back in my little red wagon. And I just pull it around with me. And because of my job, only because of the job I used to have, I was going to give a lecture on spirituality one morning. And I left my house late. Now, I'm the kind of person that I think if I drive fast enough, I can get there on time. So I left late, and I was driving fast. And I got to a traffic jam in a place where there should not have been traffic. I slammed on my brakes. We moved 3 feet. We stopped 5 seconds. We moved 3 feet. We stopped 5 seconds. We moved. We stopped. We moved. We stopped. The guy behind me lays on his horn. Now, I had no place to go except in the trunk of the car in front of me. We move. We stop. He honks. We move. We stop. He honks. Now, I'm already anxious because I'm late. We move. We stop. He honks. I finally couldn't stand anymore. I put my car in park. I put my emergency brake on and my dress-up clothes and high heels. Jumped out of my car, and I headed for his. He had electric windows. He almost got him rolled up. He missed by about this much. Stuck my arm in there. I got him by the collar of his shirt. I twisted it, and I pulled his little face to the window. I started telling him about himself. I started telling him about his mother. I suggested he do some things which I really think are physically impossible, but the veins in my neck were sticking up and I was letting him have it. And I took a breath. I had lived with that kind of rage all of my life. When I took a breath, I realized I didn't like the way it felt. And I asked God to put it back in my wagon. Now, I wish I could tell you I let him go, but I didn't. But I did loosen up a little bit, and the blood ran back to his face. And I told him I was sorry for how I behaved. I told him I believed every word I said to him, but I was sorry for how I said it. And I let him go. He got his window up that quick. I got in my car. We moved. We stopped. He didn't honk. We moved. We stopped. And the traffic cleared, I didn't have to beat myself up. I didn't have to run a tape that said, you're a lousy member of Alcoholics Anonymous. I didn't have to tell myself what a horrible person I was. I didn't have to stop and have a drink. Because I had asked God to put it back in my wagon. If I don't drink, I have a chance to do it different. But if I take a drink, I don't have a chance. If I take a drink, I'm damned to do it that way over and over and over. But because the steps work, I just asked God to put it back in my wagon. I didn't have to beat myself up, and I didn't have to take a drink. I went on and gave probably one of the best lectures on spirituality I have ever given. I wish I could tell you I was about 7 or 8 months sober. I was 12 years sober when I did that. And that defect's still in my wagon. Still in my wagon with all the rest of them. And I'm grateful that that's where they are. I'm grateful that that's where they are because it reminds me that I'm human. It reminds me that I'm human. The chapter 5 says we claim spiritual progress. I truly believe we need to claim it. We claim spiritual progress, not perfection. And my wagon of defects reminds me that I'm human. Steps 8 and 9, for me, were conventional ways of getting rid of conventional guilt. I had my list from my fourth step with alcoholic arrogance. I told God if he wanted me to make amends, he needed to put these fools in my face. People started showing up this quick. I had people in my face I'd forgotten to put on the list. I had to quick get them on the list in order to make my amends, and they started showing up. And I have a sponsor who's a real nag. Now, I know none of you have a sponsor like this. Certainly none of the women I sponsor have this complaint, but my sponsor was a real nag. She used to just find little things to get her teeth into and just chew on them. And one of her biggest deals was my unfinished business. I had started a lot of stuff. I was a great starter. And then I just kind of poop out. I didn't finish a lot, but I started a lot of stuff. And she got really concerned about my unfinished business, and she wanted me to finish up this stuff. And one of the things that really she really got obsessed with was this master's degree that I had taken classes for, but in my field I had to take oral exams and I hadn't done it. And she wanted me to finish this degree, and I didn't want to. I'd already drank myself out of my profession. To this day, I cannot work in the newspaper business in Orange County. There was no sense in me finishing it. Why bother? And she just was nagged and nagged and nagged. So finally, to shut her up, which is the reason I did most anything, I agreed to finish it. I knew I was going to have to take classes. I didn't have time. My life was too busy anyway. Nah, 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 nah. I called San Diego State to find out what I was going to have to do. And the woman put me on hold, came back on the phone and said, our records indicate that you already have a master's degree. I said, no. No, you don't understand. I never finished it. Now, and she hung up the phone. Now, I don't even want the thing, but I'm obsessed with it. I spent days trying to find the guy that was the head of my master's committee. I finally got a hold of him. I told him what I wanted to do. He said, Patty, you have a master's degree. I said, but I had to take 2-day oral exams. He said, you did. And I said, well, how did I do? He said, you were brilliant. I said, oh, of course. I hung up the phone, called my sponsor, and told her how she had humiliated me one more time. My business cards say Patty Ochoa, M.A. I mean, I look at it and giggle. I know, well, I don't know where it came from, but people I work for like letters after your name, and it just makes me chuckle. And I finished my ninth step, and when I finished my ninth step, I got right with you. I had never been right with you before. When I got right with you, I was right with me. And when I got right with me, I was right with God. I had never been right with God before. And when I got right with God, see, my life had never been enough. It had never been the right kind. I needed that job, that house, that relationship. Then I'd be okay, and I'd get that stuff. And it wasn't the right kind. It wasn't enough. I needed that job. I needed that house. And when I finished my ninth step, when I got right with you, right with me, and right with God, my life was enough. It was exactly the right kind. It had never been that way for me. Steps 10, 11, and 12, for me, I hear people talk about maintenance steps. I was even. I don't know what they are maintaining, but steps 10, 11, and 12 for me are growth steps. They're the steps that allow me to continue to come back to Alcoholics Anonymous to let you share with me how to live life. Step 10 says to me to just keep doing the process. The process is powerful. Write about it, talk about it, ask to have it removed, make amends, and move on. Don't beat yourself up. Step 10 says the process is powerful. Keep doing it. Step 11, for me, I'm a simple person. My prayer in the morning is very simply, thy will be done. I'm so naive, I believe it. I don't drink. I show up. I live life, and the rest of it is God's business. I know beyond a shadow of a fact I'm supposed to be here tonight, because if I wasn't, I'd be somewhere else. I truly believe that the rest of my day is God's business. I'm a formal meditator. I only do it once a day, though, because I like the feeling. I would meditate 24 hours a day, 7 days a week. Anything that I like the feeling, I will overdo. So I formally meditate once a day, but my best meditation comes in meetings of Alcoholics Anonymous. My best answers come from you. I sit with you and I hear chapter 5. When I hear, rarely have we seen a person fail, when I hear that read, I come into the room with you and I know I'm safe. And I know I'm going to hear my answer for how to live life. And I know when I sit with you, I'm going to hear the answers I need to hear so I don't have to shortchange myself anymore and I can live life to the fullest. I hate 12-step calls. Why does anyone want to get sober at noon? Up until just recently, I slept alone. No sympathy, huh? No. Now, I know my sponsor had something to do with this. I know my sponsor would call central office whenever I had anybody spending the night, which was very, very rarely. But it was those nights when I'd have somebody, a sleepover, my phone would ring at 2:20 in the morning. And it was some woman that thought she wanted to get sober. I knew she didn't want to get sober. She just wanted somebody to come babysit her. And I'd get out of bed, and I hate it. I hate getting out of bed when I'm having fun. And I'd call somebody I sponsor because I figure, you know, especially I'd like somebody who just got in a relationship because I figure if I'm going to suffer, she's going to suffer too. Go pick her up. I complain the whole way over there. We get to the house. I complain the whole way to the house. I hate every minute of it. It's always cold. It's always 2:20 in the morning. Your car is always on empty. I mean, it's never convenient. I get up to the house. I bang on the door harder than I have to, and I hate every minute of it. Until the door opens, and I look in the eyes, and I see the fear, and I see the pain, I see the incomprehensible demoralization, and I look in the eyes, and I see everything that were my eyes when I walked through the doors of Alcoholics Anonymous. And I look in the eyes, and it becomes the greatest gift that you have ever given me. The opportunity to share a little bit of my dark, desperate past with another human being and tell her that she doesn't have to live that way a day at a time. Steps 10, 11, and 12 for me are like, they're like going to a department store, and you walk in on the first floor and you want to go to the second floor, and I'm pretty much a lazy person, so I go to the escalator. I always get to the escalator that's coming down. Now, you can get from the first floor to the second floor on the down escalator, but you got to keep moving. And that's what steps 10, 11, and 12 are for me. They keep me moving up the down escalator. If I stop using them, I start going down. I don't hit bottom right away. But if I don't start using them pretty quick, eventually I hit bottom, and I'm right where I was when I came to the doors of Alcoholics Anonymous. So steps 10, 11, and 12 is keep me moving up the down escalator. And it's the greatest gift you've ever given me. I came here to stay out of jail. It's all I wanted. And I've gotten so much more. My life is full today. I have a job that I really, really like and I'm really, really good at in a field that I never wanted to work in, with teenagers who I don't like kids. And I'm really good at it and I really like it. And it gives me an opportunity to give back a little bit every day that I go to work. And I leave work and I'm tired and I'm full. I have a relationship that's healthy and loving and nurturing. I used to think, you know, you'd stand in, you'd look across the room, usually where the coffee pot was. I would look across the room and the fireworks would go off and I knew that was God's will for me. And I would break my neck to get back there to let him know that this was God's will for me. And we'd go out to, if you're, you know, you go out to coffee with God's will and talk about God, because then they know how spiritual you are. And we'd talk about God and we'd have coffee and we'd take all the old timers' inventories and we knew we were right, you know, and we got move in together in about 7.5 minutes. And life was wonderful for a day or two, and then he would start breathing too hard. And he just start to annoy me, and I think, oh, Jesus, wasn't God's will. God's will was probably standing next to him. I mean, what? What on earth could I have been thinking about? You know, so I'd dump God's will and I'd start, you know, hanging around the coffee pot again until the fireworks went off again. And that's what I thought relationships were about. And I had a friend in Alcoholics Anonymous, and we were friends and we hung out and we did stuff and we were friends. And one day a while ago we talked about that our feelings had changed and we talked about it. What a novel concept. And we made an adult decision to change the nature of our relationship. And there was a tremendous amount of fear. My fear was I was going to lose a friend. And we made a decision to change the nature of our relationship. And I found for me what works is I nurture the friendship. The friendship is the most important part. I nurture the friendship and the relationship takes care of itself. And it's very loving and it's very caring, and it's very nurturing. And someone like me with no social skills who thinks going out to dinner is when somebody buys you a slab of beef jerky, someone like me can't have a relationship like that, except for the power and the magic of the 12 steps of recovery. I have a son as a direct result of my alcoholism. I keep looking at my watch. I just want you to know it doesn't work. My sponsor said I had to wear one. You know, she didn't say it had to work. We will be out of here, though, in plenty of time for the dance. I have weak kidneys, and they're just about to go, so we're almost done. I have a son as a direct result of my alcoholism. My son was 11 months old when I got sober. I never wanted to be a mother. I found out that is not adequate birth control. I brought my son to Alcoholics Anonymous meetings with me. I didn't know what to do with him. I brought him here with me, and you would take him, and you'd hold him, and you'd bounce him, and you'd love him, and you'd whatever you did. And at the end of the meeting, you'd send him back to me, and I'd take him home, and I'd bring him to the next meeting. My son's been to more AA meetings than most of the women I sponsor. He grew up here. You taught him how to love. You taught him how to care. You taught him how to be gentle. You taught him everything he knows. I couldn't have done it. I didn't know. Everything my son knows, you taught him. You taught him how to con and manipulate, too, but I guess you have to take the good with the bad. It's just, and when you could, you taught us how to love one another. And my son became one of my best friends. And I didn't think that could happen. And he's 17 years old now. And just about a month ago, he's been smoking a little marijuana. And I was in absolute denial. I think the most difficult thing for a parent is to see a child using drugs. I was in absolute denial. People were telling me, and I couldn't see it. You know, his eyeballs are hanging down to his chest, and they're red as a tomato, and I think, oh, poor smog in Southern California. And finally, I saw it. I couldn't stay in denial forever, and I talked to him about it. I took him to NA. I took him to counselor. I did everything I knew to do, and he continued to smoke marijuana. And toward the end of the school year, he came home one night, yet another night loaded, and I told him he couldn't live in my house anymore. I told him that he had to make a decision, either marijuana or living in my house, and he chose marijuana, and I understand that decision. I chose alcohol time after time after time after time. I chose alcohol over people, places, and things. I chose alcohol over job. There's always another job. There's always another place to live. There's always another something. I gave up everything to alcohol. My son chose marijuana, and he's not living in my home. I know I did the right thing. I know it was the right decision. It's very painful. It's a very painful decision for me to have had to make, but I couldn't let him, I couldn't enable him, couldn't allow him to use my house that way. And I had to give him a message, and it doesn't make it easier for me knowing that it was right. It's a very painful decision, but I know one thing beyond a shadow of a doubt. Because my son grew up here, he knows where the answer is. He knows where help is. He knows where to come when he's ready. When marijuana doesn't work for him anymore, he knows where to go, and I'm grateful to you for that. If I hadn't come here, he wouldn't know that. If I hadn't come here, he wouldn't know. And I didn't come here for that. I just came here to stay out of jail. I didn't care about him. I didn't care about me. I didn't care about anything. I'm eternally grateful to you because my son knows where to come when marijuana doesn't work for him anymore. My life is full. I've never had it so good. There's absolutely no way that I could ever repay the debt that I owe Alcoholics Anonymous. I hear people say it hasn't been necessary for me to drink since the day I walked through the doors of Alcoholics Anonymous. I want you to know it's been very necessary for me to drink. It's been critically necessary for me to drink. It's been an emergency for me to drink. But because the steps work and because of your love, I haven't drank and I haven't used the drug since the day I walked through the doors of Alcoholics Anonymous, and I never planned to stay this long. It takes a tremendous amount of courage to continue to choose to recover in Alcoholics Anonymous. I don't have the kind of courage that it takes. Cowards drink and use, I know, because I did that on a daily basis. I don't have the kind of courage that it takes to continue to choose to recover. But I come here and always the person next to me has a little extra courage. The person on the other side has a little extra strength, and you have always given me the courage and the strength that I need to continue to choose to recover in Alcoholics Anonymous. I want to end with the story that puts it all together for me, and it's the story of the man that goes to see St. Peter, and he asks St. Peter to show him heaven and hell. St. Peter takes him to a room marked hell, and inside that room are long, long tables full of food. Every kind of food you could ever think of, as much food as you could ever imagine. And the people in that room were starving, and they were dying, and they were hungry. And the reason that they were starving is they had big wooden spoons tied to their hands. And the spoons were just a little bit too long, and they couldn't quite get the food in their mouth. And so they sat amongst plenty, and they were starving. And that's how I was when I came to Alcoholics Anonymous. I was out there amongst plenty, and I was starving. And then he took him to a room marked heaven, and inside that room was exactly the same scene. Tables and tables and tables of food, as much food as you could ever imagine, any kind of food you could ever think of. And the people in that room had those long spoons tied to their hands too, and the spoons were just a little bit too long, and they couldn't quite get the food to their mouth. But the people in that room were full, and they were happy, and they were content. And the reason was is that one man was taking a spoonful of food, and he was feeding the person across the table. And she was taking a spoonful of food and feeding the person next to him. And that's how Alcoholics Anonymous works for me. I don't have my own answers. I have to come here and I have to let you feed me. And if I'm lucky, every once in a while, I have a chance to give a spoonful of this thing called Alcoholics Anonymous to somebody else. And you don't have to have a year, 5 years, or 10 years. If you have one day, you have something to give to the man or woman walking through the door. I had the privilege of taking a woman to her first meeting, and I took her to her second meeting. I took her to her third meeting. On her fourth day of sobriety, we were in a meeting, and there was a woman sitting across the table from her, and it was that woman's first day. The woman was shaking, and she was sweating, and my friend looked at her and took her hand and said, "Honey, you don't have to live that way anymore. Because I don't know what's going to happen to us here, but I believe if we don't drink, we won't get drunk. If we don't get drunk, our life will get different." And every one of us has that gift to share with another human being. When I was 4 days sober, an old man who I found out was sober longer than I had been alive told me if I didn't drink, I wouldn't get drunk. If I didn't get drunk, my life would get different. And the thing that I know beyond a shadow of a doubt, because it's been my experience, we already heard when chapter 5 was read. And it's a line in chapter 5 that says, "There is one who has all power. That one is God. May you find him now." Thank you.